really know where the cloud is. Okay, so we are starting our optimization of the peripartum period talk. So first, we're going to introduce our panel. I am Dr. Jeannie Sullivan, a general OB-GYN at CU East Denver, aka Rocky Mountain OB-GYN.
I am Nikki Popper, a doctor of physical therapy at Popper PT in Greenwood Village.
I am Rebecca Campbell, also a doctor of physical therapy at Popper PT with Nikki, as well as integrated physical therapy of Littleton.
I am Cammie Hatch, a doctor of physical therapy at Cammie Hatch Physical Therapy.
Perfect.
In Lohi.
So we've got our crew. We wanted to come together for this talk, not only to promote activity and exercise surrounding pregnancy, but more specifically to review the optimization of the peripartum period from several qualified and licensed physical therapists. For the purposes of this talk, peripartum refers to immediately before, during, and after delivery. We also wanted to say that for this discussion, we may be using pronouns like she, her, hers, terms like mother, mom, as a generalization. This is truly for the sake of smooth conversation. We recognize that not all birthing persons will use these pronouns or titles, and we support inclusive care for all birthing persons. So as an OB-GYN, we know that exercise and pregnancy for the average person is extremely low risk, but also high reward. Benefits include higher rates of vaginal delivery, meaning lower incidence of cesarean delivery and instrument-assisted delivery. We have lower incidence of excessive gestational weight gain, gestational diabetes, gestational hypertensive disorders, preterm deliveries, low birth weight, and we do know that there is a great impact on peripartum mental health with physical activity and exercise, decreased rates of postpartum depression, and there are no studies to show that exercise decreases lactation ability, so really low risk to exercise. We also know that many people in and after pregnancy experience abdominal pain, back pain, hip pain, leg pain, urinary issues, pain with sex, and issues with bowel movement. Of course, there's a reward. You get a cute baby afterwards, but this is really how we're going to move into our first talking point. So I just wanted to start by asking a question for each of us. What are our goals as a provider when someone comes to us in the peripartum period? And so I'll go first. So as an obstetrician, my goals are very simple: healthy mom and healthy baby. Of course, when someone comes to me peripartum, I want to evaluate for things that can harm both mom and baby. And once those are ruled out, then we can move to symptom control and talk about reassurance. At our practice, we always strive to use evidence-based medicine to guide our decision-making processes, but it's really important to acknowledge that obstetrics is a unique area where study design can be very difficult due to the ethical ramifications when you're not only looking at mom, but also baby. This means that sometimes we don't have those extremely high-powered randomized control studies that a lot of other areas in medicine do have. So with those recommendations, you can land in a gray zone where there's not always evidence, things are very gray or unclear. And so this is when both the provider and patient experience can lead the plan. It is very important for us to acknowledge and say, if truly we're in an area that we don't have clear guidelines, if there are reasonable options, we should review the pros and cons and weigh the patient's goals and thoughts. I try to remember that each person presents with their own goals, background, and understanding, but many times the patient's primary goal is uniquely and singly the birth experience. I absolutely wish to make this a pleasant, fun, and memorable experience, but as an OB, bottom line is my job is to keep mom and baby safe. Looking past the birth experience, and I think a few of us have talked about this before, many people come to us in the postpartum period and say they were so focused on the birth, but they didn't prepare for the recovery. So that's really why I wanted to do this discussion with you guys so we can optimize it.
Thank you. So we agree.
You're welcome.
So
that's as much talking I'm going to do.
Yeah,
the
rest of the conversation. I think we'll probably all have somewhat of a similar answer, but ultimately, I think pregnant people take classes on how to deliver their baby, how to care for their baby, oftentimes how to breastfeed, but there's very little education that happens about the changes that occur to the musculoskeletal system in pregnancy. which are far-reaching and have big implications for a lot of those common problems that you talked about. So I think our goal, regardless of whether a patient is symptomatic or not, and really regardless of the time that they're presenting to us in the peripartum period, we want to educate them on basic anatomy of the pelvic floor musculature, what's normal. And that's really boiling down to sexual bowel bladder function, difficulty keeping things in, getting things out. Those are all signs of potential pelvic floor muscle dysfunction, and just educating patients on what to look for, how to know if they might need some help, and then how to understand what pregnancy is going to change so that they can have a framework to make decisions about how they should initiate exercise, when they should initiate it. Because one of the things that's complicated, I think, for a lot of pregnant patients or patients in this period is that there's no one size fits all. It's really dependent upon their goals, their current lifestyle and job requirements, and how we're going to initiate certain exercises for the pelvic floor is really going to depend largely on that and be really individualized. But there is an overall framework with which everyone can work from to make those kinds of decisions.
Yeah, I would second a lot of what Nikki said, but ultimately I came to pelvic health because I looked at it as kind of a social justice issue in a way, where there are a lot of normalized parts of the peripartum experience that I think we now know should maybe not be normalized. And I think it's really hard to be an advocate for oneself if you don't know what normal is. So if you are coming to one of us, and like he said, we're giving you a tour de pelvis, if you will, and you're learning all about what things should look like and how they should feel relative to bowel, bladder, and sexual function, it's a lot easier to know when something goes wrong and then to be your own advocate and seek care for that before it becomes a bigger problem.
Yeah, and I mean, maybe just to add on in terms of goals in the perinatal period, using us as physical therapists as resources for all the other alternative providers, doulas, midwives. I always have a lot of those resources, lactation consultants, things like that, and also helping to kind of create the plan in that postpartum period, especially for the first 6 weeks when they really feel like they're kind of left alone. I like to kind of leave people before delivery with a pretty like thorough plan for 6 weeks, whether it is physical, even like mental health. Another provider that's a good one to send to.
Yeah, I mean, all of those things are so related. Making sure that we're getting our patients engaged with the full picture. When you guys are, or when we're all talking about exercise and pregnancy, we often will start out with the general things. Like in pregnancy, we don't want anyone to be doing high collision activities because, of course, belly can get bumped. If something also would happen to mom, then that could affect the baby. We don't want people to be laying for long periods of time flat on their back. Short periods are actually probably just fine. So when someone is doing a lot of workouts that involve floor work, many times their bodies are going to tell them when they need to move. But, you know, a full 40-minute workout on their back, not going to be one we recommend. And then just monitoring how they are coping with their exercises. If it's something that they can't talk through the exercise, then that's probably too intense for their current state. So we have a lot of exercises that we are just fine and encourage leading up to pregnancy, in pregnancy, walking, stationary cycling, aerobic exercises, dancing, resistance, stretching, a lot of water aerobics if people especially are having a lot of hip and back pain. And then, you know, we have a whole list of things to avoid or symptoms to pay attention for, such as preterm contractions, bleeding, to say this is when you should stop your exercise. But are there ones that, and of course, we don't expect you to go through each exercise because I'm sure that's hundreds. But are there exercises during pregnancy that you find that these are really high value exercises or after delivery?
I mean, I think
Dr. Hatch talking. Sorry. Have to name everyone later. Probably should have said.
I think a lot of it depends on what they were doing before pregnancy. If this is someone who had a really high activity level, a lot of lifting, a lot of running, impact, then, you know, they don't necessarily need to stop during pregnancy. They can kind of carry on with some adjustments and like modifications. And then also paying attention to symptoms and stuff like that. So I think it just kind of depends. If it's someone who was not exercising before pregnancy, I always use that time. There's a lot of change happening anyways to actually initiate an exercise program. And I would say I get the most benefit out of resistance training, which I think is also supported in the research with resistance training. So resistance training, but kind of have to work with the person. And if it's someone new, then you ease them into it slowly.
This is Dr. Nikki Popper, and I agree with Cammie. I think there is a lot of variance depending on the person, of course, but there are some hard and fast rules, I would say. So if any type of exercise is leading to pain, there's a lot of different types of pain, but one we often hear about is pubic symphysis pain, pubic bone pain, which is often going to happen really early in the pregnancy when relaxin is at its peak and then it stays elevated. So like around 8 to 10 weeks, we could start to see some pubic symphysis dysfunction even well before a patient is quote unquote showing. And there's a lot of movement patterns that would be really harmful to work through with that as an example. So with that example, anything that's really asymmetrical, like lunges, single leg work, down to the way you put your pants on, if you're kind of hopping on one foot to put your pants on, that could lead to increased pubic symphysis dysfunction. And that's definitely not a pain that we want anybody pushing through. That could make it worse. And really that goes for any kind of pain. If it is back pain, round ligament pain, any kind of pain is a sign that the system's probably not working properly. Same with leakage. If something is causing someone to leak urine or air or gas or bowel, that is too high of a load for the musculature, or the system doesn't know how to work in coordination to protect the pelvic floor, the abdomen, and the body. So we want to make sure that any kind of exercise is not causing those types of symptoms. There's a lot of hard and fast statements about abdominal exercises and what is safe. The ultimate risk for diastasis recti and any kind of urinary or bowel dysfunction, it all links back to increased intra-abdominal pressure. So Valsalva type maneuvers. So you can safely crunch if you know how to do it while managing abdominal pressure. And that is a simple statement that is a much more complicated task to be able to complete. But I would say foundationally, probably every pelvic PT is starting with an assessment of how their patient is breathing and what their abdominals and pelvic floor muscles do while they're breathing. So we're teaching the importance of exhalation with exertion so that we can decrease that pressure. So if someone's lifting weights but they're too heavy to breathe through that exercise, they could make a diastasis recti worse or a prolapse or create incontinence. So there's some nuanced recommendations around breathing, but in general, if it hurts, if you can't breathe, if you can't keep a neutral spine, if you're leaking, you need a modification.
Yeah, and I think the assumption is often, I went into pregnancy super fit already, and I've been doing these things, so they must be safe for me to keep doing. But there may be a bit of that that leads to overload or not knowing how to change or alter or modify the exercises that you're currently doing to accommodate for that increase in intra-abdominal pressure, because there are more things going on in there in the moment when you're lifting those same loads. And, you know, we can see a change in coning or doming within a single session by just tweaking how someone breathes or their body mechanics or the timing of the muscle patterning. And those are things that, like Nikki said, are very person-to-person dependent and hard to just give a blanket statement for, right, but know that that's a really big component of how we support people through exercise.
Are there, and you guys kind of broached on this a little bit, with asymptomatic patients, are there ones that you guys would say, you know what, maybe this person should see a physical therapist early in pregnancy, especially being in Denver, we have a lot of athletes. Yes. Just your thoughts on who should we maybe be giving this information to, especially when they're highly motivated to keep exercising in pregnancy, which is great.
My biggest one would be runners. Perhaps like your CrossFitters and athletes too, sport, just because, you know, the recommendation for return to running in that postpartum period is really 12 weeks. And once they get that clearance from you, people come to me all the time. Okay, well, I got cleared last week from the OB and I'm going to start running. And, you know, I think if we as PTs can see them through the pregnancy period, I can do a lot of education around the why of why it's 12 weeks. And we can work on all of those core, like connecting to the core muscles, managing pressure, working on pelvic floor contractions and relaxations. And that can usually make things a little bit easier in the postpartum period so that, you know, they have that plan, they understand where their timeline is, and we're preventing any further injuries later down the line.
I think it's really important, that timeline you mentioned. So we as obstetricians reevaluate patients at 6 weeks postpartum, because that is when the female reproductive organs should have gone back to their pre-pregnancy state, or the uterus should have fully involuted. That's a time where often bleeding patterns change and kind of people's milk supplies will be likely where they're going to be. And so it's a great time point for us to say, okay, the uterus is back to normal. Things have healed well. It's given, you know, the perineum physically after a tear time to heal. Looking at the incision and saying that, okay, it should be safe if you resume intercourse, but that is a very individualized assessment. And so even if your OB-GYN says at your 6 week visit, your uterus is back to normal, we as OBs can definitely do better at making sure to reinforce everyone has a different timeline for exercise, bowel function, bladder function, and sex.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, during that first 6 weeks, maybe they're not doing a lot of physical activity. So there's also that period of building back muscles in order to be able to tolerate these, especially like high intensity activities. And that's typically another 6 weeks, 4 to 6 weeks, depending. So just kind of getting that timeline, I guess.
Yeah, I would add to that that I often talk about just phases of tissue healing for my patients. And I'll use a scab as an analogy, which isn't perfect, but it works to explain what's going on. So we know that like for the first 2 weeks after delivery, you're going to be in an inflammatory phase of healing. So that's as if you just cut your arm is bleeding, you need a Band-Aid on top of it to stop it from bleeding. You don't have scab formation yet. So you're just going to protect that skin, keep it clean. That's kind of how I view those first couple of weeks postpartum. You might need to be icing your perineum. We want you, resting, establishing bonding and breastfeeding, and really treating that like it's not an injury, but maybe a tissue insult. And certainly if there's a tear, there could be an injury. So those first 2 weeks, we want to protect that tissue. And there's, again, some like, it's not a hard and fast, like clock strikes midnight and you're on the next phase of healing. But then after that, we start to see like scab formation. So as the body is starting to lay down some new collagen fibers, that tissue is starting to kind of reorganize again and be able to withstand more load. So once you have a scab forming, you probably don't need your Band-Aid anymore, but you could still slough the scab off and potentially create some bleeding. So that's a perfect example of if you are walking or exercising postpartum and you have increased bleeding, you know that that's a sign that that was probably too hard on the uterus. So we want to just monitor how much you're bleeding to understand if it's correlated with exercise. It is normal to still be bleeding in that time frame, but if the exercise you're doing is causing increased bleeding, that's a sign that you pushed too hard for that phase of healing that you're in. And so when folks are closer to that like 6, 8, and then into the 12-week marker, we're really starting to see those fibers get more organized. People start to feel better. Usually the tissue is not as red and swollen. OB tends to clear them from pelvic rest and safe to return to exercise. And that's a really critical window where I find a lot of patients exercise too hard because they don't have the knowledge of how to gradually build back up again and how to monitor their tissues for what is safe. So what we're doing in that period really depends on what their goal is. If their goal is to run a marathon, I'm going to have them doing much higher load exercise at that time. If their goal is just to be pain-free and just heal normally, I'm going to be doing more like Pilates-based type exercises and just match the exercise to their goals. But we really don't want to see folks loading that tissue at a high impact until 12 weeks in general. That's like running, jumping, HIIT workouts because of phases of tissue healing.
And I really like to use a framework for returning to any kind of impact loading, which allows it to be a little more individualized based off of, you know, can we practice these precursors to running, for example, like we have a return to run protocol is what I'm referencing. And it's ways for us to test the waters with certain movements that are close to running, but not quite doing the actual thing to see if they have any increased bleeding, like Nikki mentioned, or other things that are telling you that your body's not quite ready for what you're doing yet, which might be incontinence. It might be, you know, pelvic pressure, heaviness, which could signal that you're in prolapse land or getting there. And I think a bigger, more empowering part of the process is just teaching someone how to listen to what their body is telling them and translate it into, okay, is this me being fatigued because I'm out of practice, or is this me needing to have a conversation with my body about how I should dial this back because I'm not quite there yet?
And I think you all each mentioned it. So trusting a woman's symptoms to help guide where they are at with their recovery. And some of the things that I know we quote it, what we're trying to prevent is, of course, dysfunction. So having pain or inability to do those things that we are looking for in the recovery period, peeing, pooping, going to the have sex, getting back to your normal exercise routine. And then also you mentioned it, pelvic organ prolapse. And so that can be the front wall of the vagina coming down, which is typically the bladder. That can be the uterus coming down in the middle. And then the back wall of the vagina sometimes can protrude through, and that's typically really the intestines, but most commonly the rectum. And so these are things that long term, we've seen a lot of people who have had children, whether or not it's C-section or vaginal, the risk is higher, but we can see, especially in some of our really high intense exercise people, or athletes, we see it sooner. I mean, people sometimes in their 30s and 40s. And so we are talking about optimization, but some of this is also prevention and stopping before things go wrong. I think we did want to ask, I have a lot of patients who ask about thoughts on Kegel exercises. Would one of you want to talk about how and when you should initiate Kegels? Or if.
Sure.
This is a hot topic.
We all have a lot to say.
I mean, initiating, I think it's important to have a
And connection. Sorry, what is a Kegel exercise?
Yeah,
sorry.
So a Kegel exercise is the conscious contraction of the pelvic floor muscles that at the base of the pelvis. The pelvic floor muscles, while we can consciously contract and relax them, most of the stress that they're getting actually comes from the whole system. But having that connection with those muscles is important during pregnancy and postpartum. As far as doing Kegels all day long, which was commonly recommended, that's not typically necessary, especially if there's any sort of pain presentation, pelvic pain, low back pain, even leaking sometimes is because the muscles are a little bit too tight. Any pain with sex. So we'll assess to kind of see where their tone and coordination is at and kind of take it from there. But as a general recommendation, you don't need to be doing 90 Kegels a day. Yeah, is what my mother was doing.
Yeah, that is it. Old school was Kegels all day long, all the time. And I think maybe you had mentioned, Cammie, the relaxation is very important with a lot of these exercises, and that was something I don't think is stressed.
And not to imply that there isn't a time and a place.
Right, right.
But I think of it more as if you are trying to reestablish a connection to a muscle. So maybe you don't have any volitional control postpartum. you might train something in isolation for a short time, just to reestablish a connection, but because the pelvic floor is part of a larger system, I think Kegels do the most good for folks when they're in the context of where they need them in their everyday life or an exercise that they really enjoy doing. So making sure that that piece of the system is firing, you know, when somebody is in a lunge or a squat or what have you, is a pretty important piece of the puzzle.
Yeah, I think great answers. I agree. I think that when it comes to Kegels, a lot of folks don't realize that there are two types of muscle fibers in the pelvic floor. So there's fast twitch fibers and slow twitch fibers. And if we do need to be doing Kegels, it can be helpful to know which type of Kegel to be doing, if as just kind of a blanket statement that wouldn't necessarily apply to everyone. But for something like prolapse prevention, we're going to be a little bit more in tune to what those endurance fibers are doing, how they're able to support the overall core. And then for someone who's having like stress incontinence, leakage when they cough or sneeze, that's going to be more fast twitch muscle fibers. So it is important that if someone is practicing Kegels, that they're practicing the right type, and that they do know how to turn those muscles off. Because if folks are walking around with a tense pelvic floor and then there's a load that comes down on that pelvic floor, if it's already in a full state of contraction, it probably won't have enough gas left in the tank to support them, whether that's preventing leakage or protecting them from prolapse. So I'd say more often than not, at least in our practice, we are telling people to do fewer Kegels. And there's definitely a misconception that, like, if you're pregnant, you're going to end up with this really weak, loose pelvic floor. So a lot of our pregnant patients come in and they've all of a sudden really increased how many Kegels they're doing. And that really doesn't support their overall goals, especially in the third trimester when we really want to be helping those tissues to relax, to just move out of the way as uterus contracts to deliver baby. So I am fairly opposed to Kegels in the third trimester. In general, I would say I never just have someone do seated Kegels or laying down Kegels. It's always going to be functional. So we want you to Kegel and exhale as you get up from a chair, Kegel and exhale as you roll over in the bed. And those are things I teach people to start like day one, as soon as they can.
So for other prevention strategies, so Kegels, you know, most commonly talking about control of if you said things that could fall out. For the condition diastasis recti, which is a condition that is hard to, I think, clinically or diagnose in a very objective way, but subjectively, a lot of patients report that because of their rectus muscles moving more laterally or out, they feel that the belly kind of outpouches more or pushes out, sometimes looking in the mirror, feeling like they look like they're bloated, although they may not feel bloated. And so I think we have a lot of patients who come in during pregnancy saying, my sister had this. I'm so worried it's going to happen to me. What can I do in pregnancy and after?
I mean, I think a lot of that.
Hot topic.
I think a lot of it comes down to pressure management in pregnancy and kind of like, you know, learning how to manage the pressure, because in pregnancy, the rectus is going to separate because it has to grow. So the separation is not so much the concerning part as being able to control the pressure in the abdomen and use the core correctly. Timing issues were mentioned earlier. And then how that all goes together based on their specific goals. I do think it can be better managed in the postpartum period if you're really working on it during pregnancy.
There's a lot of research to support that.
Yeah.
Like what? I'm just kidding.
I'll send you there's a lot of studies that show like when the physical therapy is initiated, that there's a reduced like diastasis recti can improve faster. It can be less symptomatic, less impactful. And we know that there's a lot of PT interventions that are really, really helpful for diastasis recti. I think like something that's really tangible for people especially in the OB's office. I know when I had my kids, after my ultrasounds, the ultrasound tech or whoever was in the room almost always would offer their hand to me and pull me up like in a crunch to get up from the supine position. And that's a perfect time for patients and providers to look and see if they spot any of that doming, especially since abdomen's probably already exposed. So even just as they lift their head, if someone lifts their head and they see that the middle of the abdomen is pushing forward in like a bread loaf type shape or a tent type shape, that's a sign that pressure's not being managed properly, that internally there's tissue pushing on that loosened connective tissue. And if you repetitively do that type of movement, you're going to make it harder for those muscles to come back together again postpartum. So that's a great time to say, hey, try to exhale as you do that, or try to do a little pelvic floor contraction. Think about like if you were holding back gas or trying to stop your urine flow, can you do that and exhale at the same time as you sit up? Do we see as much of that doming? Or maybe there's no time for that. And you just say, hey, a better way to get up right now that would be universally safe for your abdomen would be to roll on your side. So you're not having to activate those muscles. But we don't want to fear, we don't want to create fear that like all those movements are bad, because you have to do that type of motion, especially postpartum, breastfeeding, maneuvering in bed. It's really hard not to engage your rectus abdominis. So ideally we're teaching people really early on, like in little snippets, how to do little things to manage it. And I would say blow as you go for me is like the most important thing. Exhale as you go.
Yeah, I think as a paradigm shift, we're trying to move towards being less limiting. And if we can change how someone does something so they can keep doing the thing the way they're already performing it, that's ideal. Instead of saying outright avoid this, this, and this. Because it also feeds the narrative that you are like a little delicate flower to where if you sit up wrong, something horrible is going to happen to your body. And I think we all know that the female system is a heck of a lot stronger than that. But we do also have the opportunity, if we try a bunch of different things and the load is just too great for the system to manage safely, to teach ways around it or compensations or things to do instead. But that tends to be my second attempt if I can't do it the other way first. I also think a really sneaky thing in terms of whether it's diastasis or prolapse or what have you that I want to mention is constipation prevention and management.
If anyone sees me in the office, I mention it every time, and I apologize to all of my patients. It's so important.
Really, it is.
We talk about poop every
day. Every day.
And I think you should talk about poop every day, because it's such a huge thing that if it's not well managed, the trickle-down effects in terms of the any kind of vulnerability in the system is going to be made worse by that situation.
I'm so glad you mentioned.
Yeah, it's a low-hanging fruit. Like, that's one of the first things to ask and address. And there's a lot of ways to improve that. And
a lot of safe things that you can do with your regular diet, but also medications in pregnancy that are actually data-supported.
Yeah, it's like dates.
It'll come back. It'll totally come back. Okay, so I think maybe talking a little bit more about the unfortunate things that can sometimes happen with deliveries. So we can't always have a vaginal delivery. There are many reasons that a vaginal delivery is contraindicated for patients, though that is still the rare scenario. But we have patients who have C-sections, patients who also have instrument-assisted vaginal deliveries like vacuum or forceps. For instrument-assisted deliveries, one of the big risks with having that type of delivery, although it often expedites delivery, which can be important if the baby is not doing well or for a couple of other reasons, many times we have higher order perineal lacerations, which are cuts that happen between the vagina and the anus. We also know that that's very common in any sort of vaginal delivery, medicated, unmedicated, but the larger lacerations, the third and fourth degrees, are ones that the anal sphincter can be damaged. And of course, no one wants to have any sort of incontinence down there. If someone has not had these anal sphincter injuries, but they have had, say, a forceps-assisted delivery, what are your thoughts on initiation of pelvic floor physical therapy, or would you recommend waiting until someone has a symptom?
I definitely am a big proponent of like preventative-based referrals. I think in an ideal world, I think every pregnant person would be referred to physical therapy, and during and afterwards. So I think anyone ideally would be just at least told that this is out there.
Yeah,
like there's a lot of common things that happen after delivery. Tears are really common. Diastasis recti is really common. Prolapse is pretty common too.
Mm-hmm.
And while it might not be available to everyone, although there are a lot of insurance-based pelvic PTs, there's a lot in this area. At least just knowing that, hey, if you're experiencing those things, there are pelvic floor physical therapists that can help you. You know, ideally what we're teaching a lot of, we have a nice opportunity to have a little more like, I think, air time with our patients. Like mm-hmm. we have long appointments. So it's a really good opportunity for us, especially early in the postpartum period, to just be like looking for signs of infection. And just as a secondary provider to help check blood pressure, you know, just assessing all of the systems too. And getting that early is a great way to prevent some of these, you know, statistics that we're seeing about, you know, maternal fetal health in this country. But in terms of the like perineal tear specifically, you know, icing is just like a huge thing that we're telling people to do. And like, it seems in the hospital that goes on, but then so many people go home and just don't think about icing that tissue. So regardless of the stage of tear, that can be iced for, you know, the first couple of weeks or even longer, certainly, that can make a tremendous difference. And that's such an easy thing to do. Once that tissue has, you know, healed from the infection standpoint, which would be really your OB clearing you, probably around 6 weeks, then we can initiate lots of stretching and relaxation exercises to help that tissue to move again. And then also massage techniques to break up that scar tissue. And that's regardless of the stage of tear. I think a stage 3 or 4 absolutely should be referred to PT just every time. Ideally, like I said, I'd like to see everyone referred, but I know that's not how it all works. But we just know that the likelihood of having incontinence or dysfunction is going to be much higher with those higher degree tears. What we tend to see with the lower stage tears is pain with intercourse.
Mm-hmm.
And that can lead to a whole sequela of problems. And then also urinary dysfunction, because that's where those fast twitch muscle fibers are. So if there's a lot of scar tissue on the fast twitch fibers, we could see incontinence because they're not able to contract enough. We could also see incontinence because they're not able to have like proper fiber alignment be relaxed enough to then contract when they need to.
I also think that we have the luxury of guiding people through the nitty-gritty of getting back to sexual function in general, and that we are a very kind of uniquely positioned provider to give people stepping stones back to what they were doing before. I mean, I kind of think of it like exercise, to be honest.
Yeah.
That infrastructure's changed a little bit, and it's not, you know, all of a sudden you're clear and then you go for gold. There's a lot of in between.
Yeah.
I like Nikki, I'm huge on the preventative piece. So even if it's one visit where we talk through, you know, like exploring your scar site, how does it feel when you move it this direction or that, and showing you some basic techniques to help to free that up and make it more comfortable for you. And also identify if you think that there's something more going on that you need some help with. That can be really, really powerful. And just giving people a place to talk about it and problem solve. I mean, we walk through different positions you can try for penetrative sex and a whole slew of things that I just feel fall through the cracks quite a bit in terms of what's happening in that immediate postpartum period.
Agreed.
Yeah, and especially with issues around sex, I like to involve the partners as well. Sex is a two-way street. So, you know, that's the other advantage, is not only educating the woman or the person who gave birth, but also the person they're having sex with, especially if there's a lot of manual techniques that need to, that are beneficial, or that we kind of feel what you need to do. We can teach the partners how to do that, which also kind of plays into return to intimacy and all those important things around the relationship, which are going to affect every other thing down the line in terms of just overall function and quality of life.
One more thing to add too is the risk of having painful sex is nervous system upregulation. So when the brain and the nervous system detect threat in the form of pain, the muscles are going to tense up. Fight flight mode comes in, there's going to be muscle tension, and that's going to further perpetuate that pain, because if you're having pain with penetration and you're tensing up your muscles, that's essentially closing the door. We want to be opening the door. And if the brain is sensing threat, it's going to have a hard time relaxing your musculature. And when folks continue to push through painful intercourse, that can really spiral into a bad place where not only is intercourse painful, but then tampon use becomes painful, or, you know, it can really get extreme. Feeling your underwear can be painful. So a lot of treatment for perineal tears, even the small degree ones, is nervous system regulation and teaching people how to recognize what their thoughts are around this and what their muscles do in response to that. And I think when they're on our table, that's a great time to see it. If we see them, you know, breathing with their chest rising and falling, they're clenching their legs together, yeah, that's a great time for some education.
I also want to say just one thing about that, because I see this happen a lot. It's important to acknowledge that sometimes that muscle memory, especially like Nikki said, if people can continue to try to muscle through pain, becomes a reflex. Like, it's not something they are intentionally doing. And I have a lot of patients who come in and they assume it's something that they're doing or not doing wrong. And it is important to acknowledge that that's not always under your volitional control. That is absolutely something that we can help you with. And it is very person to person dependent how we go about that, but the nervous system is always a piece of pie.
Yeah, and we're not just dealing with muscles and nerves, but also the tissue. When someone has just had a baby, whether or not they're breastfeeding, but more commonly when they are breastfeeding, we see vaginal atrophy. There's a drop in your hormones, things get very dry, and so one thing that we are trying to talk about more about is lubrication, foreplay, talking about vaginal estrogen, which is safe for a lot of patients, but making sure that if it seems like the return to function is slower than average or triggering or causing these responses or tightening, that we more readily get access to our pelvic floor PTs and less of, oh, well, you'll push through it. That is not really actually a thing. And so I think we all can work on capturing it early, but talking about it makes it easier because a lot of women don't. So that is helpful. So other things can cause third and fourth degree lacerations, really just vaginal deliveries can cause those. Are there any techniques that you talk to your patients about while they are pregnant or after? Well, not really after, but while they are pregnant, to help prevent those higher order lacerations, even if we're planning for just spontaneous vaginal delivery?
Definitely. There is research to support perineal massage as being effective, and it is a totally risk-free intervention unless you've been placed on pelvic rest, which
is not common.
There we go. Thank you. So, yes. Perfect. So unless your OB has told you it is not safe to have something internal, you know, there's potential high yield and virtually absolutely no risk to doing perineal massage. So we universally recommend that at 35 weeks on. We often start that earlier just so that they have the knowledge, but, you know, really encourage that tissue being stretched, like leading up to the time. And when you're touching your own tissue, it is a form of biofeedback. So that's a perfect time to practice a belly breath and see, what does my pelvic floor do? How does that tissue feel? We want that tissue to descend or move down when you do a big inhale. If it's through the diaphragm, so a big belly inhale, you can feel that tissue move down. And that's really helpful for labor prep, because that's going to mimic what we want to be doing during contractions and also what we want to be thinking about with pushing. And then also that's what we're going to want to be doing afterwards to help any tears to heal as well. So we teach a lot of diaphragmatic breathing for relaxation, perineal massaging, and then there's a lot of different stretches that can be done as well to really target that tissue. Deep squats would be one of those, happy baby, butterfly type stretching. And some of those stretches we might be recommending also to help optimize fetal positioning and to help spine mobility, and other problems can be helped by that too. I also really like to have a handheld mirror for my patients so they can take a look at that tissue, get a visual on, okay, when you do a Kegel, it lifts, when you release, it drops. Let's practice now like a couple gentle pushes and see what direction that tissue goes, because a lot of folks think they're pushing, but they're actually doing a Kegel, and then they can see that in the mirror. And then if they have an epidural, especially, or just if they need a little extra assistance, if a mirror can be brought in during delivery and they've already practiced that, they would hypothetically have a lower risk of tearing if they were better able to relax those tissues, if they've already practiced that.
Yeah, I think that is such an empowering thing for people, and it's really magical to watch the kind of light bulb go off when someone realizes, oh, when I breathe this way, or I do this thing, this happens, and it's a form of control that I don't think people realize they have. And just also exploring positions where they have maybe better command of relaxing. And I often like to explain it in terms of, if your pelvic floor is more relaxed, if you have really good control of that, if the gate is as open as it possibly can be, you have to use less pressure to get baby earthed. So it is a win-win for everyone.
Right. And both of you mentioned positions. So we do have many patients who deliver unmedicated, which is great. Of course, you have your full mobility, your body kind of guides you into whatever position is going to work for delivery. But we do have many that are medicated. And I just want to say, like, as an obstetrician, epidurals do not mean that you can't, that you have to deliver flat on your back. We have a lot of different positions that we can use. Yes, sometimes we can't always do hands and knees if it's unsafe for the mom to bear that weight, but that's not always the case. And so many of the things that women are practicing for birth, just because you have an epidural doesn't mean that we can't do that. And so I do want our patients to feel empowered. We always have mirrors, but to use the things that they've been practicing, which can sometimes help them to feel that they have an ounce of control in a very uncontrolled setting.
I think one tip that is often really, really effective if they do end up on their back, just taking a towel and getting that pelvis just tilted forward a little bit, just sliding something under pelvis so it can tilt forward so that gravity is more on the side of baby coming out versus having to like take an uphill climb, especially if they're on their back and like knees are pushed up to their chest. That's just the wrong direction for the pelvis to be in. So I'm always saying, like, you know, if all else fails, and this is how you deliver, which it happens, and sometimes that's what your body is calling you to do, and sometimes that's the best position anyways. But, you know, at least we can minimize some of the downsides to that position just with a simple pelvic tilt.
Yep.
We like squatting, sideline, over a peanut ball is great. Yeah. Lots of movement is ideally
peanut ball, that, you know, not for the recording, but that thing works amazing.
It's so cool.
Isn't there also a little bit of research on sideline, like in the presence of medicated delivery, that sideline reduces the severity of care?
I don't know off the top of my head, but
it may, but it also works really well. Yeah, babies tolerate that position quite well, so it's a nice spot to be on. I think the last question that I know a lot of us wanted to address, just because we have so many of our patients who've experienced a C-section will have firmness at their C-section scar. So what are your thoughts on scar massage? In general, we, at least from our side, we encourage people to not do it until 2 weeks, but I'd like your thoughts, because you're seeing a lot of probably the more severe cases because they're getting referred to for that.
I mean, yeah, there is the tissue healing component that is there. Sometimes when there's a lot of sensitivity, we'll start with like a cotton ball. So you're not doing aggressive massage right away, but you are trying to desensitize that tissue and, you know, create that tolerance, if you will, while it's still healing. And then it creates a nice, you know, gradual increase to where you can get a little bit more aggressive once it heals more. Sometimes it even starts with the woman just looking at the scar. Sometimes there are some of the psychological impacts that come with C-section scars. But it starts kind of where they're at and goes from there.
That's another time where I'm often giving an icing recommendation with caution that that skin is usually going to have some sensation deficits and you can burn yourself with ice. So you have to be careful with ice, but ice goes such a long way in those first couple of weeks for reducing inflammation, also providing a little bit of desensitization, just putting some pressure there. So many people we see, I think, kind of get like out of sight, out of mind. They don't want to look at it. and then they might miss something like signs of infection. Mm-hmm. So we really want them looking at it. That's going to help the nervous system. Definitely before 2 weeks, we'll start desensitization for sure. Want to be able to not touch directly on the incision because of risk of infection, but all around that tissue, that's going to help bring that sensation back, help that nervous system to recover. And definitely I teach everyone scar massage that comes in.
Yeah. I am a big fan of working in the periphery, making sure we're not, you know, tensioning too much along any plane, but I mean, even some light manual lymphatic drainage above and around the thing is a really, really helpful thing for people. And it just starts to reacquaint you with the area that has looked really different in wildly different ways. But I also, I have a little bit of a divergent perception around scar work. I think it should be a component, absolutely, especially if there is some tenderness, but there is one PT who's done some research on this and not wanting to have the scar aggressively over-mobilized to the point of laxity, that yes, do some scar massage to make sure that it's not stuck on the tissues below it and have people work on it to their comfort, but that then shift the focus to more almost like mobility from below. So you're learning how to activate the muscles underneath the scar line. You're giving them rhythmic movements, is something I do a lot, that allows them to kind of expand and open their abdomen. So we're playing with mobility and making sure that, you know, they don't do anything except massage for 4 weeks and then they go to reach for a plate on a really high shelf and all of a sudden they're having these kind of shooting pains or this mobility restriction. So I think I always do scar work, but I make sure that it is accompanied by some mobility tools as well, which I'm sure y'all do as well.
And it is, I mean, that's just such a common thing about what we all do is when you're doing one piece, there's still 10 other pieces that you're trying to do at the same time. So this talk is not to replace someone's physical therapy journey, but it is to just help acquaint people with some of the things that can happen, some of the interventions that we can do, and to just, open up the conversation so that we all have more resources. Cool. Let's see. Oh, yeah, I just wanted to mention, so after this, we'll have this transcribed and put on our website. We will, you know, add in some of our references, but also links to the practice for Dr. Popper, Campbell, and then Dr. Hatch's practice as well. Cool.
Great.
Okay.
Thanks for
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you.